I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to a London Review of Books podcast.
Nobody expected Penelope Fitzgerald to win the Booker Prize in 1979 for her novel Offshore. Keneally was also on the shortlist, with Naipaul's A Bend in the River the clear frontrunner. Julian Barnes remembers Paul Theroux, who was judging, saying he would skim out into the pampas the candidates he considered non-starters. Back from Patagonia, there he sat at the Booker dinner, a polite smile on his face. I couldn't help enjoying the dinner, Fitzgerald wrote to a friend shortly afterwards, though the Evening Standard man told me frankly that they'd all written their pieces about Naipaul and felt they were free to get drunk. Unlike the others on the shortlist, Offshore was short, deep, highly crafted, about a colony of misfits in London in the early 1960s, living on boats and with the certain failure that kept causing them to sink back into the mud moorings of the great tideway. Was this the reason for the pampas skimming, that the book was so small and sad? The author was quite old and unglamorous, as photos taken at the dinner attest. Fitzgerald always struggled with what she called the problem of evening dress, and wore a long flowery cotton garment like a flannelette nightie. Did that give licence to the next day's BBC book programme, opened by Robert Robinson on the proposition that the judges made the wrong choice? A favourite aunt, a jam-making grandmother, putterish, distrait. This is the sort of thing people wrote about the figure Fitzgerald presented, finding a dissonance between the performance and the craft and brains of the books. It's tricky enough dealing with these women writers, but one who's old as well and didn't start publishing until she was nearly 60, it's difficult to compute. Penelope Fitzgerald was 62 when she won the Booker, a widow and the mother of three grown-up children. And although no longer in straits as desperate as those she had drawn on for the novel, she was accustomed to making do on very little. She lived on the ground floor of her married daughter's house in Battersea. She made her own clothes from material bought in the sales and seemed never to acquire a handbag. Acquaintances remember a trusty William Morris carrier, and she took a sponge bag, Hermione Lee reports, to the Booker dinner. In her letters, she uses the dotty lady shtick for two main purposes. It's there to entertain and mollify her daughters, on whom she depended for all sorts of things. For example, Marina Warner came to lecture at the Highgate Institute on Tuesday, embarrassing as the members had made a clean sweep of all the sandwiches and canapés by the time she got into the reading room. And it's used defensively to protect her privacy, for example. Have written to David Godwin pretending not to understand exactly and hope that will keep him at bay. After Offshore, Fitzgerald wrote six more novels, of which two more were nominated for the Booker. Since her death in 2000, it has become common to talk of her as one of the finest recent practitioners of the novel in English, admiring in particular the technique and mystery of the final books. In the words of A.S. Byatt, who worked with Fitzgerald at Westminster Tutors, the London Crammer, she was, quote, not an English lady writer, though she put on an act as one, but someone with an austere original talent. And Byatt presents the way she came to understand this as an epiphany. She said to me about human voices, the scent rising, perhaps, from the sausage roll Fitzgerald was warming up on the radiator for lunch, that she wished I would write something to point out that it was based on a German poem by Heine, Der Asra. Fitzgerald's fourth novel, on the face of it a tragicomedy of love and loss among careworn bosses and dewy office girls at the wartime BBC, resonated, in its author's mind at least, with a poem in which a Yemeni slave explains how, for the people he comes from, to love is to die. We are talking about a writer for whom intellect is a passion, and whose books as much recount romances with whatever she has been reading as they do anything else. This is one reason the tag of historical novel, often attached to the final books, is inadequate. They aren't set in periods so much as inhabited or even haunted by other works. In Innocence, which was published in 1986, the highlight is the astonishingly precise and sympathetic portrait of Antonio Gramsci, dying in a Roman prison. Tolstoy himself does not appear in The Beginnings of Spring, which was published in 1988, but his legacy does, in several variations, comic, beautiful, menacing. Her last novel, The Blue Flower, which was published in 1995, recounts scenes from the youth of Novalis, and so the everyday life world of the German Romantics. So I Have Thought of You, the title of her selected letters, is, in a way, typical Fitzgerald. It looks so cosy and mumsy, but it isn't. It's from Gute Nacht by Wilhelm Müller, as set to music in Schubert's Winterreise, as forlorn and desolate a lyric as they come. Fitzgerald's novels, Byatt concludes, are best approached as, quote, very English versions of European metaphysical fables. English, maybe, in the sense that Muriel Spark was Scottish and Isaac Dinesen Danish, and that Marguerite Duras was French. Byatt does not make this point, but it's worth noticing, surely, that this minor modern tradition often attracts women writers, maybe because its minority and smallness work well with limited resources, or because its irony makes sense to writers in secret protest over the limitations within which they work. As a conventional literary career, Fitzgerald's life's work was, as one reviewer put it, quote, an awful hash. But really and truly, in what universe does the phrase literary career even make the slightest sense? Not on a leaky houseboat when life is a daily struggle to look after all the people you have to look after. Nor, presumably, in the realms of ethical life and spirituality. Though she said and wrote little about it, Fitzgerald was a practicing Anglican, and when she went on a coach tour of what she called the Holy Land in the early 1990s, headed straight for the Jordan to be rebaptized. It's not that Fitzgerald's work is pious or even kindly. Geniuses are not nice people, as Byatt saw. Here's a quote. She blinded herself, in short, by pretending for a while that human beings are not divided into exterminators and exterminatees, with the former at any given moment predominating, Fitzgerald writes of her protagonist in The Bookshop, a novel that opens on a quiet vignette of English nature. A heron swallowing an eel, the eel struggling to escape, both creatures trapped forever because, quote, they had taken on too much. It's that this numinous dimension gives weight and bearing to the poles around which the work revolves, as seen in a very late story called The Red-Haired Girl, which was published in 1998. On the one hand, and I quote, there is nothing really lasting, nothing that will endure, except the sincere expression of the actual conditions of life. Conditions in the potato patch, in the hayfield, at the washtub, in the open street. And on the other, here's another quote, the withering sense of insignificance that can bring one as low as grief. Fitzgerald's novels divide into two phases. The first group are short and spare, with English settings and clear autobiographical parallels. The Bookshop, Offshore, Human Voices, At Freddy's. In the second, she has absented her personality, hidden it deep beneath Princess and Pea layers of material. Florence after the Second World War, in Innocence. Moscow, just before the first, the beginning of spring, Cambridge at around the same period, the Gate of Angels, pre-Napoleonic Saxony, the Blue Flower. One imagines the author building up the research, bit by bit, joining it from many sources, then cutting it to ribbons, before reassembling the tiniest threads of it in the most delicate dreamlike structure, only the bits she wants and no others. And yet, the result is the opposite of decorative whimsy. It has inevitability and form. The method emerges, startlingly developed, in the very first paragraph of her very first book, the Burne-Jones biography. Fitzgerald sets up a dialectic between, quote, the daily life with its successes and disasters, and, quote, the inner life of a painter who might have said with Jung, If I had left these images hidden in my emotions, they might have torn me in pieces. The work's images thus become what Fitzgerald, following her subject, calls its burden, the points at which physical manifestation connect to inner preoccupation. And this is a quote from the Burne Jones biography. The enchantment of the willing victim, sleep, waiting, imprisonment, loneliness, guiding, rescue, the quest, losing and finding, and above all, as for Burne Jones's friend, William Morris, the language of flowers. So the idea of writing about flowers as a means of communicating and yet concealing the secrets of the heart was, as Hermione Lee says, with Fitzgerald for a long time before becoming the quest of her final book. What other things make up Fitzgerald's burden? Well, Frank Kermode was right early on in the London Review of Books in 1979 when he noticed the fascination with water in its many forms and depredations. Damp, flood, rain, drowning, the dead man's stench of river water, the long-awaited torrents that come when the ice cracks in the beginning of spring. Those retiring, recessive protagonists are another. How many times do you have to read Innocence before you notice Cesare? The very odd, foreign unto themselves Englishness of the pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood and the Arts and Crafts movement might be another, as manifested in the love of colour and clearness, craft, plant forms, and the romantic re-enchantment of nature. The hands like nymphs around the birch trees, the flower with a face on it in the rocky crack. And as for the heron that the bookshop made its emblem of the English countryside, surely this is it again, the quote, delicate, grotesque silver bird on the De Morgan tile scavenged by the children from the mud in offshore. The pre-Raphaelite interest was profoundly, though obliquely, autobiographical. Fitzgerald had known Burne Jones's window in Birmingham Cathedral since she was tiny. It was the first time I'd seen something that I realised was stunningly beautiful, she said. And it tickled her that it had been installed when her plain-living grandfather had been posted there as suffragan bishop, as he had no aesthetic sense whatsoever, she said. And the pre-Raphaelite line continues, right the way up to the blue flower, via George MacDonald, whose fantasts inspired generations of grot and goblin writers, and who was the translator of the Hymns to the Night. In fact, MacDonald was the only English-speaking writer who really understood Novalis, as she wrote in a letter to Kermode.
Thanks for listening. For more, go to lrb.co.uk